This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick.
Hi, I'm Kelly Fasane. I'm a staff writer at the New Yorker Magazine. And on behalf of the New Yorker Magazine and the New Yorker Festival, thanks for coming out, whether you're with us here.
Last month, a crowd gathered in Brooklyn to hear from a special guest.
The guy I'm sitting next to has been destroying stages ever since the 1980s, when he was a rambunctious punk kid playing with hardcore bands in the D.C. area.
Rock musician Dave Grohl.
It's true! He changed the world with Nirvana and then kept changing with Foo Fighters, who were now 10 albums into one of the most epic rock and roll runs of all time.
Dave Grohl's epic run began as the drummer for Nirvana. And then after the death of Kurt Cobain, Grohl became a frontman with his own band called the Foo Fighters. On this Thanksgiving weekend, we wanted to take a little break from the news of the world. And we're going to bring you two conversations with two musicians from last month's New Yorker Festival. Later in the hour, we'll hear a performance from Amy Mann. But first up, here's Dave Grohl. Grohl's new memoir is called The Storyteller, Tales of Life and Music. He joined staff writer Kelly Fasane on stage at the Skyline Drive-In in Brooklyn. Now, it's out on the Brooklyn waterfront, and as they talk, you might hear something creaking in the breeze off the East River.
Please freak out for Dave Grohl.
Awkward.
So Dave, we're here at the New Yorker Festival, and we're here to talk about your literary career, which began at age 14, I think around there, with a letter you wrote to your dad.
Well, okay, so both of my parents were writers. My mother was a public school teacher for 35 years. She taught, yes, let's hear it for the teachers.
Yes!
We love the teachers. She taught creative writing, and she was a forensics coach and a debate coach. And my father was a speechwriter and a journalist on Capitol Hill. We grew up outside of Washington, D.C. So not only the written word, but also spoken word in our house was valued. So that, I don't know if I told you, but we would do these articulation drills at dinner.
What?
Yes. My mother would give us a topic to speak about, and we'd have to speak for maybe 3 minutes without interrupted speech. So it could be anything. It could be brownies, and you'd have to talk about brownies for 3 minutes without saying or like or you know. So also, they were great storytellers. Mm. Anyway, so what you're referring to was my runaway note when I was 14 years old, where I finally kind of ran away from my dad's apartment. And it was a defining moment in my life, because at the time I was playing music, but I wasn't allowed to because I was such a horrible student. And I was playing in punk rock bands, and in these punk rock bands, you basically did everything yourselves. right? You made your own records, you made your own t-shirts, you booked your own shows. So I had tried my hand at becoming a promoter.
How'd that go?
I made $100. It worked out okay.
Did the bands get paid?
Everyone got paid. And I made $100. It was great. But anyway, so yes. So what you're referring to is probably that.
Yes.
And, you know, it was at that point where I was discovering independence. Mm-hmm. And I talk about this sometimes that, you know, there's a golden window of opportunity in every child's life where independence and identity intersect. And so you're no longer just like arm candy, like holding your parents' hand when you cross the street. You're allowed to become who you're going to become. And at that point, I knew that I was going to be a musician and that I was going to have to do it all myself. And so that was the beginning of that.
And you set this down, I mean, you set it down in an actual letter, like a manifesto, right? It was like, here's what my life's going to be like.
Yeah, I mean, I was basically just saying, you know, if you only knew what I did last night and everything that I put into it, and I did this all myself, and I'm proud of me, and so I think this is what I'm capable of, and if you don't have faith in me, then I'm just going to go do it on my own. And so I did.
This.
Kids, stay in school. Don't do drugs.
So it seems like your story with music, there is this origin story involving the song You're So Vain.
So, okay, so also both of my parents were also musicians. So when my mother and I would drive around in our car, we would sing along to 70s AM radio.
Right.
And there was one day we were driving around and Carly Simon's You're So Vain came on. And we're both singing like, you're so vain together. And then it gets to the chorus part and I was singing the Mick Jagger part and my mom was singing the Carly. And so we break off in harmony, and it was in that moment that I realized and understood that two different notes form a chord. I'm like, wait a second, hold on a second. And then the kick drum does that, and then the snare drum does that. And then, so I started listening to music, not just as a sound. I was like listening to music and the patterns. And some people experience this condition called synesthesia, you know? Right. Where you can actually see sound. And it kind of started happening to me. I would imagine music in these sort of Lego shapes in my head. So if it's still to this day, like if I hear a drum track, I can hear it and see it in these shapes. So it's great because I don't read music. That's how I memorize things in my head. Mm. So if you play me a drum track or an arrangement of a song, as I'm listening, I'm visualizing it, and then I can play it back for you like that.
Right.
So, yeah, that was a huge moment. And that's when I fell in love with music. And that's when I, like, went home and was playing with the Beatles records on the floor, playing drums with my teeth. Hold on a second. Let me see if I can do it. I don't know if the mic's... I got it. All right, let's see if I can do it. Ready? Okay, hold on. Check, check. Ready? You're going to have to crank the mic for 1 second, Mr. Sound Guy. Here it comes. Ready? Okay, it's not that good. Anyway, it was so bad. I went to the f***ing dentist one time, and he's like, do you chew a lot of ice? I was like, no, why? He's like, well, because you have an unusual amount of deterioration. And I was like, oh, dude, I can play drums with my teeth.
So, you know, as a writer, I don't always get to pick my own headlines or titles, but I did get to pick the title for this event, which was Maximum Rock and Roll, a phrase that describes your life and career, but was also the title of a magazine that was important to you as a kid.
Absolutely.
A magazine that was like the punk Bible that helped kids find each other that were into punk rock, but that also had a reputation for being kind of self-righteous and kind of obnoxious. What does that phrase, maximum rock and roll, mean to you?
Okay, so for people that don't know about the underground music scene that we grew up in, listening to music, I discovered this punk rock thing in like 1983 through a cousin of mine that lived in Chicago. And I had started playing music and I loved bands like Devo and the B-52s and things like that, the Beatles and Kiss and Zeppelin. But I didn't realize that there was an underground network of bands and labels and magazines that was like this community. But, you know, before anything online, it was this really grassroots community of people that were doing it all themselves.
Right.
But yes, it was also filled with like this ethically suffocating punk rock manifesto.
Right.
Right. And so, I mean, to be perfectly honest, I was more attracted to the independence and the musicality of what was going on, or lack of musicality. Right. It was just the energy of the whole thing I thought was very cool.
But you've said, I mean, in your book, you talk about those years and how you go from playing with Scream in D.C.
Yeah.
to suddenly you're in a big band and your relationship with this punk rock world
yeah.
is changing.
Well, it's difficult to kind of join the two, you know? Like, when you're raised in that ethically suffocating punk rock scene, you're conditioned to reject anything, any conformity, any sort of, you know, popularity or
right.
whatever it is. Nirvana came from that same scene. But there was a problem is that Kurt's songs were so good that it's like, you know, we never expected that we would become as big as we did, but it was almost inevitable with his songs and his right. lyrics and his voice, you know? So then once we became successful and popular, we felt conflicted in this way that we had sort of betrayed the scene that we were raised in the underground when we really hadn't done anything differently than we had done before.
Right.
It was just that now the songs were being heard.
Did it feel slow at the time? Did it feel like the steady thing of like my band's getting bigger?
No.
Feel like...
No, it happened really quickly. I mean, you know, the big moment was the first time we played on Saturday Night Live.
Mm-hmm.
And that was like, I mean, that's where I grew up watching that show in the 70s, not only for the comedy and the brilliant cast that they had, but for the music, because that's where I saw like live performance. I'd never seen a concert, but I saw the B-52s and I saw Peter Tosh and I saw Devo and
Fear.
I saw Fear and Bowie and things like that. So when we went to go do that first SNL, just knowing that my drum set was in the same place that all of these legends had been, I was just like, it's crazy.
Was there any trepidation? Was there any sense of like, well, I don't know if we want to be an SNL kind of band? Or were you guys just like, this is amazing, let's do it?
There was once when we were meeting with all the record companies in New York, long before anybody really knew who Nirvana was. And we were in the office of this guy named Donnie Einer, who was the head of, I think, Columbia Records or something. And it was in this you know, big high-rise office, and he's behind this big oak desk, and he's a, you know, music executive guy. And he goes, well, what do you guys want? And Kurt goes, we want to be the biggest band in the world. And I thought he was kidding. So it's weird, you know. I think that there was some sort of ambition there.
Mm.
But I don't think anybody had any understanding or any real expectation.
Would you guys talk about it? Would you talk like strategy? Like,
No.
No.
We barely talked. No, I mean, it was... We wouldn't even talk about writing songs.
Hmm.
We would begin every rehearsal with this sort of improvisational noise jam and just kind of do this free-form freak-out thing. If it was a quiet part, I would sit there and I would watch Kurt's Converse sneaker get closer and closer and closer to the distortion pedal. And I was like, here it comes. And then right before he stepped on it, I go, wa-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And that's how we wrote songs. I looked at his foot the entire time. So it wasn't like, you know, we weren't like discussing like, well, I think the bridge of this song should be in a minor key and go seven times. Instead, it was like, I watched his sneaker the whole time.
So, you know, one of the amazing things about your book, I went through it to make sure that I didn't miss something. I did like a global search through the text for the word utero.
Okay.
And it didn't return anything. And I said, this
I didn't mention in utero?
I was like, this guy made a record that sold like 15 million copies around the world. And you've done so many things in your life that like, this is just another record you made.
Absolutely not. Okay. The biggest challenge in writing this book was deciding what to write and what not to write.
Right.
The way I wrote it in sort of this short story format. And it all began last year when the pandemic hit and I had nothing to do. I started this Instagram page, Dave's Truth Stories. And so I started writing these little short stories for this Instagram thing. And then once I realized that this was going to be more than just a few weeks, I'm like, it's time to write the book. I had made a list of 30 or 40 stories for the Instagram page, and I signed a book deal, and I gave my editor the list of the 30 or 40, and I said, tell me what you want me to write. And so she would kind of short order cook me. She's like, write about joining Nirvana, write about this and that. I mean, I could write a fucking book about every chapter of this book. So it was like, I could write an entire book about Nirvana. Or Scream, or the Foo Fighters. I was 300 pages in, and I hadn't even mentioned the Foo Fighters yet. And I was just like, oh my God, my guys are going to f***ing kill me if I don't at least say like, oh yeah, and then I started another band. So it's just, it was really difficult. At one point, my editor was like, stop writing. You got to stop writing. I was like, really? Okay, so I did. So In Utero, I mean, you know, That was a difficult time. After going through the success of Nevermind,
right,
and being, you know, conflicted and at this ethical crossroads, we decide to continue, and we make an album where the opening lines are, "Teenage angst has paid off well. Now I'm bored and old." And so when I listen, it's actually kind of hard for me to listen to that record because it was a difficult time. But also because it's so real, that record. Mm. That record's real. Yeah.
Did you ever second guess yourself and wonder whether this was what you actually wanted to do?
Music?
Yeah.
No.
Even when things were at their darkest and weirdest with Nirvana?
Well, after Kurt died, I was like, I'm not playing music anymore. It's too painful. Mm. And then I eventually realized that music saved my life, my entire life. This is what's going to save my life again. But no, I mean, I never, that's probably, you know, the only time I ever stopped playing music. I've never not needed it, so.
How long did you stop for?
Oh, it was maybe 6 or 7 months or something like that. I couldn't even turn on the radio, it was hard. Yeah, and then I realized, like, okay, I have to kind of write my way out of it. Pick up an instrument and play it again, play the drums, and kind of get my way out of this that way.
Dave Grohl, the musician and author of a new memoir called The Storyteller, and he's been talking with Kelifasane. Our conversation continues in a moment. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, where hundreds of researchers make new discoveries inspired by the work of previous Dana-Farber scientists. Learn more about their momentum at danafarber.org/everywhere.
On this week's On the Media, one former NPR editor's grievances are reverberating far beyond a Substack essay. He claims wokeness is ruining the place.
That marginalized people are storming the barricades and dictating that this story happens and this story gets killed and we're going to use this language and not use that language. That's not what I saw.
On this week's On the Media from WNYC. Find On the Media wherever you get your podcasts.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. We've been hearing from Dave Grohl, who first achieved global fame in the band Nirvana.
In 1994, after Kurt Cobain's death, Grohl went on to form the Foo Fighters, and he moved from the drums to frontman, singing and playing guitar. They took the name Foo Fighters from an old slang term, pilot slang from World War II, that described UFOs. Let's pick up with Dave Grohl at this year's New Yorker Festival. He's speaking with the staff writer, Kelefasane.
As you probably know, people have ideas about drummers, right? So when people hear like, oh, the drummer's got a new thing, they're like, oh, it's going to be this like intense drum-driven thing. But you turned out to be making these amazing demos as a singer-songwriter.
Thank you.
Which is not whatever anyone was expecting.
Nor was I. No, I mean, that was always... So when I was young, I figured out how to multi-track with these two cassette decks. So I'd like record something on this cassette, put that cassette in the player, hit play on that, put another cassette in there, hit record and play drums along to it. So now I have something with drums and guitar on it, you know? So I was always into the idea of like that multi-tracking, that combination of elements, and the thing that I heard that first day in the car with my mom, that was like a puzzle. It was like a game. Mm. And so I would write and record these songs by myself, but I'm like, this sucks. And so I was just banking all of these songs. And, you know, while I was in Nirvana, I wasn't going to, like, disturb the radical creative process we already had by going in and, I mean, it's the famous joke. What's the last thing the drummer said before he got kicked out of the band? Hey, guys, I got a song I think we should play. So, you know, when you're in a band like Nirvana and Kurt's writing songs, you're like, just... this works the way it works. Yeah.
So when did you start thinking, like, maybe I should share these songs that I've been making?
Well, I sort of did on, like, some funny, like, punk rock compilations mm-hmm. in the early 90s. I think, like, right around the time I first joined Nirvana. But I don't even think I put my name on it. Anyway, after Kurt died and the band was over, I did a bunch of soul searching, and I decided, okay, I'm going to disappear. I'm going to go to the most remote place on earth. I'm just going to get away from everything and figure it out. Right. So I went to the Ring of Kerry in Ireland, where I'd been before. It's so beautiful there. And you really feel like you're just at the end of the earth, and there's nothing serene, and it's so beautiful. And I was driving around in my rental car and on a country road, and I saw this hitchhiker kid, and I thought, well, maybe I'll pick him up. And as I got closer to him, I saw that he had a Kurt Cobain t-shirt on. Mm. And it was Kurt's face looking back at me.
Jesus.
In the middle of nowhere. And I realized, like, oh, I can't outrun this. Mm. So I need to go home and get back to work. Mm. And so I did. I went back and I started recording these songs by myself. And with... really just with the intention of just continuing life. That's what I needed to do to survive, and it helped a lot.
When did you realize, like, oh, these songs that I was kind of maybe nervous to share, like, people really like them?
Well, I mean, I was literally... So I recorded the first record by myself in, like, 6 days, and I made 100 cassettes. Cassettes. And I was so... stoked that I could go to this cassette duplication place and, like, I designed the insert. Like, I picked the font.
Did you give yourself credit in the liner notes?
Unfortunately, my name is nowhere in that thing at all. I called it Foo Fighters because I didn't want people to know it was me because of the baggage that came with that. Also because it was plural. I imagine that if a band name is pluralized, that they're like, oh, it sounds like a gang, whatever. It's the stupidest band name in the world, but I was like literally giving this cassette to people at gas stations, and then someone from a record company called and said, hey, we want to put out your record. I'm like, the cassette thing? Okay, all right. But then this is the good part. This is the best part to me personally, is that then I call my manager John, my lawyer Jill. I don't think anybody expected much was going to happen. But my lawyer said, listen, don't just give it to someone. That's yours. Hmm. Start your own label and do everything yourself like you did when you were a kid. And so I went right back to where I was when I was a teenager, starting my own label, recording my own songs, and we still, to this day, like, I'm the president of our record company, Roswell Records.
When this thing, this Foo Fighters thing that started as a demo tape is becoming real, and you're putting together a band, and the songs are getting played on the radio, and I'm sure people at the record company are all excited, and kids are showing up to the shows, was there any trepidation of like, oh, I'm back in this like rock and roll star machine again?
No. Well, it was different. I knew that if I just, I had offers to go play drums with other bands, but I knew if I just sat down at a drum stool that it would like forever remind me of losing Nirvana.
But it's also more spotlight, right? You can imagine a different version of your life story where you're like, you're a working musician as opposed to the guy in the center of the stage with the spotlight on you and a guitar singing the songs. And yeah, the whole stadium is singing along.
Well, I was kind of born with a drummer mentality, which is just like keep the beat and keep the people moving.
Right.
It's a comfortable place to be. Like if I go to go record with someone, I don't walk in there like, I'm Dave Grohl, I'm going to play like this. I walk in and I'm like, what do you need? Tell me what you want me to do. And then I do it. Is that cool? And I like that. Mm. Like I like facilitating someone else's boogie, you know? It's fun. It's cool. As a front man, dude, it took me for ever to get comfortable with doing that. Mm. A decade at least. Well, you know, okay, so I had another revelation, a big moment for me. There was once where I was asked to go play at the White House. Paul McCartney was getting a Gershwin Award, which is, you know, a huge honor.
Right.
And there was a performance in the East Room of the White House, and there were all these people invited to play: Jack White, Elvis Costello, Stevie Wonder, performing in this tiny room in the East Room. It was very small, and with Paul's band. I got invited, and I'm like, oh, cool, I'm going to play with Paul at this thing. And they're like, no, you're going to sing this to Paul and President Obama, who will be sitting 3 feet in front of you, staring at you doing this thing. And I was just like, I was so incredibly nervous. And I remember being like about to walk on stage, thinking, this might be the coolest thing I've ever done in my entire life. I mean, considering growing up in D.C., being on the other side of the fence at the Rock Against Reagan concerts, now I'm in front of President Obama and Paul McCartney, and I was so terrified. I'm like, okay, I'm going to puke. I'm going to faint. I'm going to, like, this is going to be the worst thing ever. And then I stopped, and I'm like, hold on a second. This is the most extraordinary thing that's ever happened to me, and I'm going to waste it on being scared? I was like, this is only going to last for 5 minutes. And it really did. It changed me. So, you know, I was terrified to come up here with you.
Yeah, it's on the same level, I'm sure. Well, I'm going to take this moment
nice.
To thank you, Dave Grohl.
All right.
Thank you.
We'll see you next time. Thank you.
Staff writer Kelly Fasane talking with rock musician and now author, Dave Grohl. His new book is called The Storyteller, and our conversation was recorded last month at the New Yorker Festival. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. Stick around for a performance from Amy Mann coming up in just a moment.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. Thanks to Dana-Farber's foundational work, protein degradation can target and destroy cancer-causing proteins right inside the cell. It's how Dana-Farber is working to treat previously untreatable cancers. Learn more at DanaFarber.org/everywhere.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. If you're familiar with the musician Amy Mann, it may be because of this 1980s earworm. Or you may remember her soundtrack for the film Magnolia back in 1999. Amy Mann has been celebrated for her mastery of the craft of songwriting for a long time. In a review in The New Yorker years ago, Nick Hornby said that Mann writes, quote, proper lyrics instead of 10th-rate poetry. Her new album is called Queens of the Summer Hotel, which was inspired by the memoir Girl Interrupted. Last month, Amy Mann appeared at the New Yorker Festival, and let's start with a song.
There's a girl up in her bed, bleed against her skin. I see you, hoping the pain covers the dread, keeps the secret sin. I see you. You think there's no one there to hear. There's a girl over a cliff trying to break her fall. I see you, hope that she'll find where to live, clinging to the wall. I see you, whether it's black despair. Just on we, I can see wires get crossed and tangled. People bruise and they leave, but I see, and I. There's a girl over the tide, empty as the sky. I see you, dead to the world, frozen inside, drier than an eye. I see you. You want to disappear, so just not be. People get crushed and broken. People lose and they grieve, but I see, and I believe. I see.
Thank you so much.
That was Amy Mann performing I See You with Jonathan Colton and Jason Hart. It's from her new album, Queens of the Summer Hotel, which was inspired in part by Girl Interrupted, Susanna Kaysen's best-selling memoir. The title, The Summer Hotel, actually refers to the psychiatric hospital in Kaysen's book. At the New Yorker Festival, Mann spoke with staff writer Atul Gawande, whom you might know better as an expert on public health, on COVID, and much more. But Atul is also a really passionate music fan.
You know, you sent me the album, and I really appreciate that. And I saw it, I got to listen to it on a day I'd come out of my surgery clinic. For those who don't know, I'm up in Boston, and I work as a surgeon and in public health. And one song that called 15 Minutes got to me.
Oh, God.
And Susanna Kaysen, who wrote the memoir, Girl Interrupted, it opens with her going in to see a psychiatrist she's never seen before, and 15 minutes later she is involuntarily, more or less involuntarily admitted to...
Kind of coerced, yeah, coerced
yeah,
into...
To be admitted to McLean Psychiatric Hospital, where she'd spend almost the next 2 years.
Yeah.
And
which is a long time.
It's a long time. And 15 minutes was about the 15-minute appointment, which my day is made up of 15-minute appointments. It is gruesome to think about, like, how we move people in and out, right?
Yeah. I mean, I made it a funny song, but it isn't, yeah.
He's an over-the-top psychiatrist by the time you're done. You might say a couple of the lyrics about electroshock, for example.
Yeah. Let me see if I can remember it. Hold on a second.
Let's see it. Let's do it.
Give me 15, give me 15, give me 15 minutes. That is all I need to make the call. With only 15, only 15, only 15. Women are so simple after all. Something like that. In the time it takes to walk around the block, I can have you scheduled for electroshock.
Something like that. Anyway, so I didn't really take it that seriously.
It is. It's surprisingly. I mean, the memoir is actually hysterical. And you managed to bring out. I understand your attraction to it, right? It's dark and it's funny at the same time.
I mean, I think that that's sort of how you have to be if you are, you know, you find yourself in a mental institution and you're surrounded by other mental patients. You know, you have to have some humor about it, right?
Yeah. Well, so you know, I reread the memoir for this show and. The thing that struck me was it is funny and at the same time this dark sense that here are these people who've lost the thread of, I mean, almost all of them have attempted to commit suicide at one point or another in the book, and they've lost the thread of what makes life worth living. And in my own work, whether it's cancer patients or others, the question that I often like to ask people are questions about what they find makes life worth living so that we make sure we preserve that along the way. And it's one of my favorite questions to ask, as it's turned out. Like, one person I got to write about had said that, look, if I can eat chocolate ice cream and watch football on television, that will be good enough for me.
Wow.
Like, if
low
long
bar.
As you say that. So, low bar, what would it be for you? What's the minimum quality of life you'd find acceptable?
Being around my friends, you know. Yeah, I think that's the most important thing. And making music.
I was going to say, you didn't immediately say music. If you couldn't make music, that would really.
Dude, I think if the pandemic has taught me anything, it's that people need to be around other human beings in some, you know, more than one. Sorry, my spouse, but more than just one. It's I need you know, a little group of friends, and that's, you know, which is what a band is, and that's why, you know, I like to play live, and I love playing with other musicians. It's like a shared thing. It's like three brains forming to make this other thing.
The next song that you're going to do is Goose Snow Cone.
Yeah.
And this one struck me, but maybe I'm misunderstanding it, as being out of keeping with your dark tendencies. It was based on a cute Instagram photo that friends posted of a Snowy White Cat?
Well, it was inspired by the cat.
Yes.
And then immediately took a left turn into being very depressing. So.
Oh, good.
So, yes. So, don't worry. Yeah. So, my friends had this cat named Goose, and I was on tour in Dublin. It was very cold and snowy, and I saw this picture of the cat with, like, in her little cone, you know, the cone of shame, and you know, and she looked like a little snow cone because her face was like a round, white, fluffy ball, and so I started writing this song, you know, thinking that I would change the phrase "goose snow cone" to something else later, and then just you know, and it's called "goose snow cone," so it just didn't happen.
Goose Snow Cone and Amy Mann.
Looking into the face of the goose snow cone, should be shaking loose, but you do it alone. Every look is a truce, and it's written in stone. Gotta keep it together when your friends come back. Always checking the weather, but they wanna know why. Even miserable fair, I find it hard to fly. On my feet, an origami crawl. It was only the street hidden under the snow. Always snatching defeat, it's the devil I know. Gotta keep it together when your friends come by. Always checking the weather, but they wanna know why. In the midst of a fair, they find it hard to fly. Looking into the face of the snow cone. I could pick up the pace, but I couldn't go on. I just wanted a place, but I ended up gone. Together when your friends come by. Always checking the weather, but they wanna know why. In the midst of a fair, they find it hard to fly. Looking into the face of the goose snow cone. Thank you so much.
There are very few new wavers who have an ongoing musical career. You know, Duran Duran, nope. Spandau Ballet? No.
I bet Duran Duran could fill some theaters.
You can fill, yeah. But not creating new music that people still are drawn, not just still are drawn to, you building new audiences and reaching people in new ways the way you have been.
Well, and I'm lucky.
But I would love to ask you about you got there, and it was a dark journey to through record travails, record company travails. Can you tell us a little bit about what you went through before you came out the other side?
Well, record being on a major label at the point where I was in the 80s and early 90s, I think, you know, the music industry is one of those industries where people feel like there's easy money, and if they can just figure out what the formula for having a hit song is, then they will make that easy money. And then they go to the artist and they say, we need you to sound exactly like this thing that is already on the radio, and here are our dumb ideas for how to do that. And this was, I mean, that really is about the size of it. That was a situation I really chafed at, because I felt like, if you don't like the music I'm doing, then just release me from my contract. So it was just a lot of waiting that out.
You recorded Bachelor Number 2 and the album that would be a breakout for you.
Yeah, Bachelor Number 2, I had recorded and it was finished. That was a complicated situation. I was on Geffen, and Geffen and a bunch of other labels merged into Interscope. So Interscope was getting a huge influx of other artists. And they actually told me I could leave if I wanted to. And I was like, thank you, Jesus. Finally, I can get out of this. And at that point, the internet wasn't really a thing, but enough of a thing so you could have a kind of a mail order situation. And I was like, I don't care if I have to sell this out of the back of a van. I just have to get out of this situation.
So now, who do you write for? I remember seeing a talk from several writers and where they'd answer the question, you know, why do you write? And one did say, I write to illuminate relationships because it's the relationships between people I don't want to understand. The other person said, I write because I want to stick it to the man.
Well,
why do you write?
For different reasons. I really do. You know, relationships between people is very interesting. Finding or going through or observing a complicated situation and boiling it down to its essence in 3.5 minutes is very interesting. It's like a little magic trick or a puzzle. I like getting inside other people's heads and writing from their perspective to see what it's like, see what it's like, and then see where I intersect with that person. So there's different reasons, but there's something that's sort of magical that happens when you have a complicated problem or feeling, when you put that into words, and that's really interesting. You know, it's like a it's like an ink plot. It's a Rorschach test. It's you see things in it, and then the things suggest a story, and so you start writing a story, and it's just very interesting to me.
Amy, this has been just fantastic, and
thank you. Thank you so much.
One last time, please give it up for Amy Mann.
That's staff writer Atul Gawande speaking with Amy Mann. We'll close now with Save Me, which appeared on the soundtrack to the film Magnolia. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. See you next time.
I can tell. can you save me? Come on now, save me. If you could save me from the ranks of the freaks who suspect they could never love anyone. You struck me down like radium, like Peter Pan and Superman. They could never love anyone except the freaks who suspect they could never love anyone. But the freaks who suspect they could never love.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado.
We had assistance this week from the New Yorker Festival, including Catherine Sterling, Amanda Miller, and Nico Brown. Also, Michael Etherington and his team. And a very special thank you to Fabio Bertoni and WNYC's Joe Plord.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.
Come on and save me. Why don't you save me? If you could save me from the ranks of the freaks who suspect they could never love anyone except the freaks who suspect they could never love anyone. Except the freaks who could never love anyone.
Thank you.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.